Shalom. Welcome to another episode of Inspiration from Zion. I'm Jonathan Feldstein, and I have the privilege of being your host, coming to you from the Judean Mountains here in Israel. I like to refer to it as the original Bible Belt. Inspiration from Zion is a program of the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation, whose mission is to build bridges between Jews and Christians, and Christians with Israel in ways that are new, unique, and meaningful. I pray that you will find this all of those. Through this program, we're excited to connect you to stories and people in Israel to give you a window to look through, experiencing aspects of life here that you might not otherwise know about. We want this to be interactive, so please be in touch with us at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com and send along any questions and any comments about any topic anytime. Or you can follow and like Inspiration from Zion on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Stay tuned until the end, where we always offer an exciting opportunity, and please feel free to share this with others who will also find it of interest. A few months ago, I had privilege of going to visit Kibbutz Be'eri in the summer. And I met a lovely young woman whose name is Hila. We became fast friends. And the few days later, it was the day before. I had come from visiting a new friend, Guy, who's an olive farmer in northern Israel. And we were meeting Guy and going around to prepare for our very exciting program that's coming up just in a week from when we're releasing this conversation, Root and Branch, bringing Christians to volunteer to harvest olives, specifically in the Gaza border area. And from that, we're going to make olive oil and give the proceeds back to the communities in which we're harvesting olives, and hopefully not just giving some money for funding for things that are needed, but also creating long-term relationships. And between Guy, who we met in the north, who's right now, as we speak, in the middle of harvesting his olives, does he have 400 acres, I think, something huge of olive trees that some of them are 1,000 years old. So he connected me to today's guest, Yarden Tzemach, who connected me to Hila, came to visit Hila the next day with my friend and partner, Marzia Mirizadeh, who's our partner in Root and Branch. And then a few weeks later, had the opportunity to come back to Kibbutz Be'eri. Now, for those of you who don't know, Kibbutz Be'eri is the largest kibbutz. We're going to discuss what that is if you don't know, along the Gaza border. And I don't think sadly is even the right word, but in a devastating way, Kibbutz Be'eri had the largest number of people murdered on October 7th last year and kidnapped from Kibbutz Be'eri, some of whom are still in Gaza. We're going to talk about that as well. But I got to come back and meet Yarden. Yarden, and I don't know, Yarden, you get to meet a lot of people, and you're in charge of a lot of the agriculture there. And I just saw a fabulous picture you were telling me before we started recording, how you're in the beginning of a month-long avocado harvesting season, and Be'eri produces a whole lot of avocado every year. But I felt an immediate click with Yarden, his warmth, his sincerity, really representing, I think, just the salt of the earth people that you find there, but also wanting to reach out, wanting to build bridges, and noting that in their beautiful community, and it is a beautiful community, a place that you would just love to live, even with all of the devastation from a year ago, they have stunning large olive trees that I'm hoping 2 weeks from now we will have picked all the fruit of and made great oil that we will give you an opportunity to buy as well. So I wanted to reach out. This is our second conversation with a resident and member of Kibbutz Be'eri. It's now we're bookending the anniversary, both October 7th and on the Jewish calendar that we observed just 2 weeks ago from that horrible massacre. And I made a mistake when I visited Yarden. I only waited until the end. After clicking and talking about the fruit, I said, "How is your family?" And I didn't know your story then, Yarden. So forgive me for that, but we're going to talk about that today. But first, I just want to welcome you and thank you for joining us in this conversation today on Inspiration from Zion.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So I feel like I want to tell people, I don't think anyone overseas can really ever imagine what a kibbutz is, what kibbutz life is like. Can you paint a picture there? I assume you were born there and grew up there?
Yeah, I was born in Derry. I'm third generation in Derry.
Wow.
Well, my grandparents are here since the early days of the kibbutz.
Which was in the 1940s, before the founding of the state, correct?
Correct.
Yes. Yeah.
1946.
And what does the kibbutz mean? What is it? For you, it's your life. It's probably nothing unusual, but you grow up around all the rest of us who are living in towns and cities and other kinds of communities.
So a kibbutz traditionally is a very democratic, and it used to be more a socialist community that we don't own our homes. We live in a community, which is it's a collective called a kibbutz, like the old days. One of the last ones in Israel that are still collective kibbutz. So, you know, for me, growing up in a kibbutz is growing up next to your best friends, your family, you know, running around, you know, in the lawns. There is not a lot of cars. You can go anywhere. Even when I was in kindergarten, I could already go by myself from my home to the kindergarten because it's very safe. You know, everybody knows each other. So it's like, it's a big community. It's like it's a big family in a way.
Yeah.
Even these days, when I decided to come back to the kibbutz about 6 or 7 years ago, the kibbutz haven't changed much. So I don't have children, but my niece and nephew, for example, are the same. They can go around across the kibbutz by themselves with 4 or 5 years old. It's very safe. So it's very safe and it's really friendly, and it's the best place in the world for us to grow up and do the start of fabric.
Yeah.
Many of us decided to come back. Over 80% of the people decided to come back to live in Derry eventually.
Now, when you say come back, meaning you grew up and you go out for a little bit, but when you get older and you realize, I don't know if you're familiar with the movie The Wizard of Oz, but when Dorothy says there's no place like home, that's really it.
Yes. Then there is no place like home. And once all your friends are coming back and your siblings, and so what can you get better than that?
Right. I agree. I think I spent a summer working here in the 1980s. On another kibbutz, and it was just something that you connect with, and you get a sense of the freedom in the community. And I think as much as Israel offers an amazing quality of life for people and for families, I think kibbutz is probably the cherry on top of the icing, on top of the cake, as far as how that quality of life exists. A year ago, let's come into what happened. Like, why am I even talking to you as compared to someone else? A year ago, October 7th, 6:30 in the morning, rockets, air raid sirens, and all of a sudden, terrorists started storming Israeli communities all along the Gaza border. Berry is, 2 kilometers, 3 kilometers from the border?
About 4 kilometers, so just over 2 miles.
Right. And if I remember correctly, you weren't there that day.
Correct.
Can you explain?
I was actually away on the day. I was camping on the beach with friends. There were about 15 of us, friends from Derry. And we camped. We usually camp in a beach called Zikim Beach, which is the southernmost beach in Israel, just on the border with Gaza. For some reason, we decided this time to go a little bit further north, not because we were afraid of terrorists. It was there was a pollution in the water near the Zikim beach. But we decided to go an hour north to Ashdod. And we were just camping over there for the whole weekend, 2 nights. And Saturday morning, 6:30 a.m., we woke up to sirens near Ashdod. And so we realized what's going on. We didn't realize that there are terrorists in the kibbutz, but we realized that there are rockets. You know, in a way, we are used to the rockets since we are living with the rocket threats for 20 years now. So in a way, we are used to it, but of course, there was never any terrorist storming the kibbutz, as you said. There was never terrorists crossing the border coming towards the Be'eri. The only threat that we had so far was rockets. And in a way, we learned how to deal with it. It sounds funny or crazy to the people that are overseas and listening to us, but we still learned how to deal with it. It was 2 or 3 days a year when we knew it's better to, if you have a young children, to prevent the trauma, you take them elsewhere to the family, you visit family elsewhere in Israel, stay there for a few days and come back, and then it's safe again. And
I mean, meeting on specific days, you would know,
once it starts, you know, that it's probably going to go on, they shoot at us and then we shoot at them and it goes on for a day or 2 days.
Got
and
it.
There is a kind of a ceasefire and continue. So this is what we thought is the case also in this time on October 7th. So we packed our stuff and we're headed towards the kibbutz. When the police stopped us just south of Ashkelon, we didn't realize what's going on, why are they stopping us? And then from the WhatsApp groups and from our friends and family that are still in Be'eri, and from the community members, we realized that there are terrorists penetrated the kibbutz. And then we started to realize what's going on. I was in the security team of the kibbutz for the past 7 years. So I had a rifle in my home and I tried to think what's the best way that I can do. First of all, we were about an hour north of the kibbutz. So, you know, every time we practiced with the security team, the IDF always told us, even if there will be terrorists crossing the border in Gaza, the IDF will be there in 15 minutes or 20 minutes. So he said, okay, it's irrelevant for me to try. I'm just going to call a friend of mine, a neighbor of mine. And this is what I did. I called a neighbor of mine. I told him, where is my gun safe? What's the combination to the safe? And he went out, he took my gun, he took my rifle, my magazines and everything. And he went out to fight. And since that happened, I didn't try to come back to Be'eri anymore. I feel that I would be, that I can be more helpful supporting my family from a distance, that we're all in the safe room. We have 5 siblings, so we are a big family.
Yes.
But we're in a different place. I was the only one that was away. So through the whole day, I just stayed in a gas station near Ashdod, and I supported my family from a distance.
Now, and you also didn't know that there were terrorists in the kibbutz and the threat that was there, but you also didn't know that where the police stopped you. Had you continued a little further south, you would have encountered terrorists on the road where they were killing everybody who they saw. So in the end, I mean, thank God you're here, but that was something that you would have gone into much more danger had you tried to continue.
Correct. They were making an ambush on the roads, and they pretty much managed to shoot everyone that was murdered, everyone that was driving this road, at least in the first few hours.
Yeah. Yordan, I want to take a very quick break. I feel bad even interrupting this conversation. We're going to take a very quick break and then come right back.
As remarkable and miraculous as Israel is, and its very existence a testimony to God's faithfulness, in many ways, Israel's like most other countries.
You know, I want to
just
talk
as
about
there
that
are parents
day, but
anywhere,
I like to go back.
Who have stronger and weaker parenting abilities. And adults become a product of situations
there,
in their lives that they cannot control,
as an adult,
making their ability to raise and care for their own children even harder.
From Gaza.
That's true in Israel as well.
Very
the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation
before,
is committed
the saying, well, even
and
if the
takes
terrorists
the mandate
were to get in,
seriously
we'll be there within
to care for the
minutes.
Least
so there
of
was
these,
a concept
our brothers,
that maybe that
our
might
children.
Happen.
We're committed to bless and strengthen orphans and at-risk youth
Did you
to
ever
invest
think
in them,
would
to empower
happen?
Them
and
so that
what
their
was your
future
connection
will be brighter
to
than their
the,
past
to
or their
the Gazan
present.
Residents? Did
but
you
Israel
have
is
any
unique
relationships
in that there are
that
always
feel one
threats
way or
of war and terror,
where you live
which know no bounds.
Whether a terror attack
for children who come from homes that are not safe,
could happen.
Sometimes the very scary reality
no, there
of
was
living in a community that's
saying,
not safe
was like,
is too much to bear.
We
are committed to turning orphans and at-risk youth into children of promise. We fund a variety of programs to help those most in need as widely as we can. We invite and encourage you to join us today so that we can ensure their brighter tomorrow. Please visit genesis123.co to find out more and to send your love and most generous donations today.
It's possible, but we never thought something in that scale would ever happen, of course. As to the Gazan people, you know, we were neighbors, but we didn't really want neighbors. We couldn't go to Gaza. They couldn't. In the last 3 years, we had a bit workers that came to help us. Or to work for us for the picking of the fruits. This is the kind of workers that the government supplied and gave us. We didn't have the option. These were the only workers that we could have. And so there were Gazan workers for the past 3 years before October 7th. But I can't say that we had, even though we were neighbors, we can't say that there were any relationship between us.
Right.
And there was, you know, sometimes a working relationship as they will come to work for us. But in the past, there used to be, until about 20 years ago, there used to be workers that came every day from Gaza to Be'eri, doing the working in the construction, electricity, things like that. But that all ended about 20 years ago. So
yeah. And you're too young, I suspect, but also until the 1990s, there were Israelis who went into Gaza all the time. You mentioned going to the beach. People go to the beach. They would go shopping. It was a very normal thing, wasn't it?
Yes. And I had the opportunity to go in 1999 to go as my father and my grandmother with my father and my grandfather to Gaza. And yeah, we were at the beach. We were in the markets. I only been there once. This is a civilian, but yeah. So when I was 13-year-old on the 1999, I still have the opportunity to go there.
Interesting. Okay. Now let's move back to, if you don't mind, to October 7th. You're in a gas station near Ashdod, normal traffic under an hour or so to get back to Be'eri. And you're getting all these text messages. And I do want to emphasize the point, because it's very significant, that you, as a member of the rapid response team, Kitot Konanut, you had a gun. You didn't have it with you, but you had a gun there on the kibbutz. What was happening? What were you hearing that morning?
I started to hear that in multiple areas in the kibbutz, people are hearing gunshots, and they're hearing... Of course, everybody were in the safe rooms because of the rockets that were flying early in the morning. But people started to hear gunshooting and Arabic outside the window. So people started to realize. And since I collected the dots and I said, okay, this woman is hearing and this guy is also hearing, but they are not even neighbors. So I figured that it's not... two or three terrorists, there are many of them because they are in multiple places in the kibbutz. And there was not much that I could do, but I was trying to prepare my parents and my siblings that were there. My oldest brother was also in the Kitat Konenut, and he went out to fight, to protect the community. He left his his wife and two children at home. He directed his wife how to put the baby's bed under the handle of the safe room door and how to put the fridge in front of the main door of the house. And he went out with his rifle and went out to fight. And also the rest of my family was in their safe rooms. So I tried to just to support and to be in contact with each of them. Every few minutes, I would send a message to make sure that everyone is fine and our work can help. Later in the afternoon and during the night until Sunday morning, I was directing army forces into the kibbutz. I was like a middleman between the people of the kibbutz. They sent me the messages with information of where they are or where they are hearing shootings. And I moved it to the war room of the army, and then they would know where to send their troops. But in the first 7 hours, there was no why the IDF was not there.
Right. And that was actually publicized, what I want to say, 2 months ago, maybe 3 months maximum. There was a big article and expose of the, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm going to say the failure, but the fact that the army didn't go in, and not only didn't go in, but was waiting outside because there was not instruction or clarity as to whether to go in, how to go in, and there was no, in fact, they weren't prepared. In fact, they weren't prepared.
It was a failure, and they weren't prepared. Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned your brother. This is where I feel guilty, and it's it may never. Maybe you didn't even recognize it when we first met that time, and I only asked you at the end about your family, and you told me about your brother, because that really should be the first thing that we should be having in conversations, not just with people in the Gaza border communities, but all around Israel. We're all us, not like you, but everyone's dealing with levels of trauma. That should be the first conversation. You told me about your brother. Can you tell everyone else, please?
Yes. So my brother, after he left his wife and children behind, he went out to fight and protect the community. He was sitting on a strategic point in the dental clinic. This is the place where they kept the injured members of the Kitat Konenut, the security team. And the medical team of the kibbutz were there. So him, my brother Shafar, along with Eitan Haddad, the other member of the Kitat Konenut, were there to protect their injured friends and the medical team of the kibbutz. But also they were in a very strategic point in the kibbutz next to two major junctions. And they actually managed to fight off the terrorists and prevent them from crossing these junctions. And they managed to kill tens and tens of terrorists and to prevent them from getting to the center of the kibbutz. And they did so for 7 hours. The IDF was still not there the whole time. And they fought for 7 hours. But after 7 hours, unfortunately, they ran out of ammunition. And then they couldn't fight anymore, so the terrorists went on and murdered them and the rest of the people that were in the dental clinic. There are two survivors from this fight. One is Nirit, she was the nurse. She was hiding in the bathroom. And the other one is Yalieris, and he was one of the injured members of the security team. He was already covered with his own blood and vomited on himself and everything, so when the terrorist arrived, he just pretended to be dead. He played dead. So this is what saved him. But the rest of them, including my brother, Shafar and Eitan, who was also a very good friend of mine, they were murdered along with the other, with the medical team of the kibbutz and the other injured members that were there.
And if I'm not mistaken, more than 100 people from the kibbutz were killed.
Yes, 102 in total. Some were murdered on October 7th. A few other of them were murdered in captivity in Gaza. 36 were kidnapped So the last one that was murdered from the area was Karmel Gat, who was murdered. She was one of the six hostages that were executed in Rafah.
At the end of August.
In the end of August. So, yeah, the total, we have 102 members that were murdered. You know, this is out of a community of 1,200 people.
So yeah.
About 10% of the population. Each family, almost each family was affected in one way or another. Some lost a brother like myself. Some lost their parents. Some of the family were totally wiped out. And you know, this is a small community, so it's still, you know, we are all connected and we are one big family.
Right.
We are all connected in multiple ways.
Yeah. I imagine of the 102 people, there's nobody you didn't at least know casually, correct?
Correct. I knew all of them for all my life.
So I have two questions. I don't know which direction to go. I think maybe we talked about it. I don't know. But I know I want to use an example. That morning, my son and my son-in-law were both called up into reserves. My son went down right away, and he was in another kibbutz the next day, still fighting terrorists on the 8th. My son-in-law, his base is south of Berry in a place called Re'im, right near where the Nova Music Festival took place. And he was told not to come down because the roads were dangerous and his military base had been infiltrated by terrorists. And he probably would have been killed if he had gone down there. And I think he will feel guilty to the rest of his life that he didn't go down, that he didn't do more. How do you, Yarden, you're sitting at a gas station, 15 miles maybe from home when all of this is happening? How do you deal with that today? Is there a sense of guilt? Is there a sense of you wish you had done something different?
You know, at the beginning, I did have the feeling of guilt. You know, especially after losing my brother, and I thought maybe I could be there with him to help him. But, you know, when the time went by, I realized that, you know, first of all, I gave my gun away about 10 minutes after the terrorists infiltrated the kibbutz. My neighbor was already taking my gun and went out, and he fought and he did well. He managed by himself to kill by about 15 terrorists. So, you know, I did feel guilt at the beginning, but I know now that I managed to help a lot, whether it's to the rest of my family or other members of the community with support and with directing the IDF troops later on. Basically from the afternoon until Sunday morning.
Yeah.
The whole night. Mm. So it was something that, you know, once you experience something like this, you will feel guilt no matter what happens. But eventually the logic told me that I did whatever I could and I managed to help a lot. So I'm happy that at least I could help.
Right. You could, and you did. And so what you're describing obviously made a big difference. And had you been there and had you gone out with your brother, you could have been the 103rd person who was killed. And that you would have taken down terrorists in the process. But your fate might have been the same. And ultimately, our fate is only in our hands to a limited degree anyway. Yarden, I want to take one last quick break, and I'd like to come back and talk to you more about life there today and the future.
Friends, Israel's at war, and the war may get worse before it gets better. Much worse. It's going to be a long war because the enemy is the epitome of evil. It's not just a matter of overcoming troops on a battlefield, but overcoming a theology, an ideology, an evil one. While the Genesis 123 Foundation has been overwhelmed with the support of so many donations to the Israel Emergency Campaign, there's so much more that needs to be done. We've invested your donations that we've received so far strategically to make the biggest impact possible, whether helping with soldiers and their equipment and personal needs, to providing civilian security for outlying border communities, to relocating and settling several families from near the Gaza war zone, launching the global petition drive to support Israel in the face of pressure for a ceasefire, and long-term needs for at-risk children, traumatized now more than ever before. Please take a moment to pause this conversation right now and go to love.genesis123.co and donate generously. We value your trust, and we will keep all donors informed about how and where your donations are being used to contribute to make the biggest impact possible. And when you use that link, love.genesis123.co, you can also send your prayers and words of encouragement to Israelis of all backgrounds, just sending your love, something that we need so desperately. Thank you, and God bless you and your loved ones.
Okay, you're done. You know what? I don't think I can thank you enough. I hope that you don't think, and others, when we have these conversations, don't think that it's voyeurism, like it's people looking to try and peek in on something that's illicit or creepy. And I hope that it's something that's comforting and gives you strength, Chizuk. But you know, when I've only been to Berry two or three times. It's beautiful. And if you look, and if your back is to the buildings that have been destroyed, it's stunning. It's beautiful. It's a place that anyone would be happy, thrilled to live and raise a family. But how do you live there now? Most of the community hasn't come back yet. How do you live there now when every day you're going by the houses in which the people were killed, and there's still so many signs of that, and most people haven't come back yet?
Yes, well, I came back to live in Berry. The first time I came back to Berry was just a few days after October 7th, but I started to come back to live in Berry about 2 weeks after October 7th already, or in the beginning of the end of October. I already started to sleep there some of the days. And I came back to work and first of all, to pick all the fruits that we had to pick. With the help of amazing volunteers from Israel and from around the world, basically, who came and helped us for several months and picked all the fruits with us, that we were relying on Thai workers and Palestinian workers, and we didn't have neither of them. So we had to pick the fruits, and we called out through social media and through the media that we need help picking the fruits, and the amazing people of Israel and people from around the world came to help us. And it was an amazing experience. But you know, for me, coming back to Berry in the first few days, I saw all the devastation. I felt the urge to come back and to do whatever I can to fix and to rebuild this place. And to, I wasn't there to fight on October 7th. I know that I helped, but in the first few days, I felt like I could do more. And you know, it was my time to, in a way, to help. You know, I wasn't there. I wasn't fighting in the security.
Oh, I see.
And I wasn't in the safe room fighting for the handle, or just feeling the terror of everyone who was in Berry on that day. And, you know, I felt the need to do my part now and to do whatever I can for the community. And I came back after 2 weeks to live in Berry. I walk, I still walk, you know, two jobs, and do whatever I need for the community. And, you know, it's true that, you know, you go by and you have these memories, and you know that in every corner something horrible happened. But, you know, we will live with these memories anyway, wherever we will be.
Good point.
This is also our home. So for me, the mission and give me a big sense of meaning to go and do something which is bigger than myself and to be a part of the rebuilding of Be'eri.
Yeah.
And to rebuild Be'eri for me is not just about Be'eri. It's about coming back to Be'eri. Is not about just about me or Be'eri. It's something that is bigger than that. It's about the whole state of Israel and about even the free world. If we will back down and we will abandon this place, the border, there will be much more October 7th and it will be all over Israel. So for the state of Israel to be existed, we need places on the border like Be'eri. And especially after something like this happened, we need to make Be'eri bigger and better. And this is my mission. This is I find a big sense of meaning on doing that.
I appreciate you sharing that, and I like how you realize that it's bigger than Be'eri. One of the reasons Be'eri is where it is because it was put on the Gaza border. But interestingly enough, not as the border of the state of Israel, because the state of Israel didn't exist then. In 1946, it was a border area. It could have been anywhere along there, and that was the nature of the people who founded Be'eri. And tell me if I'm wrong, and feel free to go in any direction you want. I suspect that in the last year, the nature of how you look at that and that sense of responsibility specifically to the country has changed somewhat. Am I correct?
Again,
the nature of how you look at the sense of responsibility, where you are as the front line. It's not just the place that you grew up, that's home, that's beautiful, that you care about, and everyone there is your extended family. But am I correct in making a leap that you realize that you are still part of this Zionist project of building the land.
Exactly. You're very correct. You know, I lived in Be'eri not because of the Zionist or living by the border before October 7th. I lived there because this was my home and this was the best place in the world for me.
Yeah.
So it wasn't about, you know, we had a great life. We had a comfortable life. We saw that the pioneering days are over. We have great lives now, and the Zionist role of building or Yeshivot is behind
the settlements, the communities settling the land,
communities and living on the border. We saw these days are behind us. These were our grandparents who were the pioneers, and they built. You know, when they came to Be'eri in 1946, there was nothing. There was just dust and dust. No, the land was not cultivated. There was no trees. There was nothing. And they created a paradise, really. Yes. Much it was the best place in the world. And we never thought in our life that we will be pioneers. But now history decided otherwise. And now we are. I feel the inner need to go and rebuild and go on the footsteps of the people who were before us and build the land and build not just the kibbutz, the whole state of Israel. And this story is still continuing. So these days.
It goes as wide or political or anything as you want. What was your sense before October 7th? And what's your sense now about whether we can actually ever have peace with our neighbors?
I don't think it will happen anytime. Maybe not in our lifetime. You know, since the Palestinians, they learn from a very early age in school that Israel is, the Jewish people need to be destroyed. And it's very hard. You need, it will take, you know, years and tens of years, maybe more, to change that, because since they grow up in this this mentality, it's not something you can just go and, you know, sign a paper and say, okay, now we are in peace. It's something that is deeper than that. It's something in the culture. It's something that is needs to be. It will take very long time. If so, to make any kind of agreement, we will just have to be to do whatever we can in the meanwhile to keep our safety and our security. And
yeah. And what if I were speaking to Yarden Tzemach 2 years ago, in November of 2022, coming home from a long day of harvesting avocados, and I asked you the same question about peace with our neighbors? What would you have said anything different?
You know, I wasn't thinking that, you know, the peace is in sight back then, but I thought back then, first of all, that probably the people of Gaza are, you know, they want peace. It's just that the leaders don't want peace or things like that. You know, on October 5th, 2 days before October 7th, I had Gazan workers in the fields. And I had about 30 of them in the orchard picking the avocado with me, for me. And, you know, I didn't even took my gun or my rifle. I felt very sad. These are people that I knew for years. And today, of course, I don't think that there is much difference between Hamas or the people of Gaza. It's all the same, you know, even as a, you know, you speak to soldiers who are in Gaza, they can tell you that in every house there is a tunnel, there is a Hamas flag beside the permit to walk in Israel. So we know now that these people were probably given info to Hamas, and bringing them in the past 3 years was a big mistake to get them to walk. We thought that if, you know, if they will have a financial, if it will be good for the economic of the Gaza Strip, or they will have a better life financially, they would like to keep the, you know, the ceasefire or something like this. We know now that it's an illusion. I mean, it was an illusion, you know, it was naive to think that. I guess that's, in a way, the culture is very different than our culture. And it's hard for us to imagine how someone else thinks. When we think in one way, it's harder for us to imagine how others think.
Right. We project how we think and assume that that's how other people rationally think. And what we've learned, unfortunately, in the last year is that that's not, or 13 months, that's not the case. And and the funny thing, Yarden, it's not funny. The ironic thing is nothing that we knew on October 5th when you were harvesting avocados with 30 Palestinian workers from Gaza. There's nothing that you didn't know then about all of the facts that you know today, except that we have all gone through that terrorist massacre and the 13 months of war since.
Yeah, it's true. They always say that they want to kill us. We just have to listen. Yeah.
I don't want to neglect, as we wrap up, Yarden, as we're speaking now, in a couple of days is leaving on a trip, speaking in different locations throughout the U.S. It's something that Kibbutz Be'eri is taking on as a serious responsibility. It's not just an opportunity, but as a responsibility. And I don't have, as we're speaking now, details about how to arrange that, but I do want to offer anyone who's following to please be in touch if you, your church, your community synagogue would like to have host people. Because one of our commitments from Genesis 1:2-3, which goes back to the whole idea of harvesting olives as a beginning, as something that we're going to do, God willing, on an ongoing basis and for everyone's benefit, is long-term relationships. So that's what we're looking for. And I don't want to neglect to mention that. Jordan, I think my last question, although I'll always ask you if there's anything else that you want to add, if I didn't cover it, where do you get your greatest strength and comfort from these days?
I think it comes from the support that we receive. You know, I say that on October 7, we experienced the worst form of humanity is possible, that is possible. But since then, we are experiencing the best form of humanity. And we are accepting so much love and support from the Jewish people around the world, from Christians, from people who love us and love Israel, and people from the free world everywhere. And, you know, it all started with clothes, that everybody were evacuated from their home with nothing but the clothes on their body. Most of them were left with a pajama because right. That's what they wore on 6:30 a.m. on Saturday morning. And, you know, we got clothes and we got shoes and we got everything we needed, and we got support and therapists who came and helped us. And you know, it's been 13 months now and we are still getting so much support. And so this is what gives us the strength. We couldn't do it by ourselves. And, you know, before October 7, when, you know, on the weeks after when I started to take people around and show them around the kibbutz, I didn't know the Christian, the evangelist Christian community or the Jewish Americans. And now I really feel that we are all a one big community in a way. We are all together. Even American Jews, Jewish in New York, his life has changed on October 7th.
Right.
It's not just the people from the away. We are not alone on this. We suffered, of course, the most physically and everything, but October 7th changed the life of Jewish people wherever they are. And I now realize it, and I know that we are all only together. And yeah, we are all a big community in a way.
Thank God for the positive thing, but I suspect you would agree with me. It would probably be better if, actually, it's a good question. It would be better if October 7th had never happened and you never met any of these people and you still lived in your bubble.
Of course, we would do everything to bring my brother and the rest of the people there. But this is what happened, and we are, you know, it was a horrible thing, but a lot of good things happened in the result. Not by any means that it was worth it, but we can still see that many good things happened. And, yeah, at least that
be grateful for the good, even.
Yeah,
and maybe
even
that
in the
good,
worst way, you can be grateful for the good. I really believe that the fact that I was saved, and anyone has saved in Kibbutz Be'eri against, you know, we were hundreds of terrorists against 11 people from the security team.
Wow.
Against hundreds of terrorists for 7 hours.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And we still lost 102 and not 200, 400, 500, 700. You know what I mean? It could easily be much worse. And thanks to the heroism and the sacrifice of my brother and others,
yes,
it could have been much worse. So I say I'm grateful for everybody who survived. And then I see the, you know, it was a miracle. Everyone who survived is a miracle in a way.
Yeah. Well, Jordan, thank you for sharing. I'm closer to it because I live here, because very few Israelis, I think, have not been impacted even if we don't live in the Gaza border, even if we didn't have anyone killed, even if we didn't don't know anyone personally who was kidnapped. I'm very grateful for you sharing, especially for all of our listeners. Thank you so much. And I want to wrap up the conversation now, as we always do, just encouraging you to share this program, especially this one. They're all pretty good, but this one especially so. We always have an offer that when you like, comment, or share the link to this program every month, we offer you we call it a project from Jonathan's bookshelf. You can't see my bookshelf. It's a big mess because in addition to collecting children, I collect books. And but we've been the last 14 months, we've been offering our book, Israel the Miracle, which is a $75 retail value. It's an inspiring, stunning book. And all you have to do is like, comment, or share the link to this program. And we're picking one person at random every month to receive this. I do want to always thank our friends at the Willow Run Greenhouse in Culpeper, Virginia, for being our sponsors of this program. And if you're ever in Culpeper, Virginia, swing by and thank them for helping making these conversations possible. And also special thanks to our friends, the Coin family, as well, for their meaningful sponsorship. Inspiration from Zion and all the Genesis 123 Foundation programs are made possible by donations. So please consider joining us to help continue dialogue like this and building bridges. And every episode, we dedicate it in honor or memory of somebody. And I have the prerogative as the host of doing this one, Shachar, in memory of your brother. Yarden, in memory of your brother Shachar, and in memory of the 101 others who were murdered that day and subsequently. And please, God, in honor of the return of those who are still hostage after nearly 400 days in Gaza. If you'd like to sponsor an episode in honor or memory of a loved one or special occasion, please be in touch at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com. We love always to hear your comments as part of a dialogue. So please send any comments, especially about traditional Judaism, for our Ask the Rabbi programs as well. And please share this with others who will also find it of interest, and continue to join us right here where we bring you more meaningful conversations about unique topics in Israel that you won't hear anywhere else. Wherever you are in the world, I pray that you and all your loved ones are safe and healthy. And I send my blessings from right here in the Judean Mountains. God bless you. Hallelujah. Al-Mashiach.